I went to waveguide and to the interface, which is the flat waveguide using microwaves. So, back to you.
Yes, please, feel free.
Billy Joel has a song, "He Didn't Light the Fire," which is an excellent compendium of the last century of history. What I just heard is an excellent compendium of various topics of electromagnetic theory, and I'm completely baffled by the wide range of it. But on the subject of point sources, I believe there are two point sources in existence today, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and I think you know why I'm saying that, Roy.
Let me talk about a point source in electromagnetism. So, what is point source if you want? Because Dr. Roy didn't agree with my comment. And what is line source? What is the pattern that is created by both? And it's a very specific name for both. And how does inverse square law apply? Or what is the difference of inverse square law applied to Yagi's antenna, omnidirectional antenna, Yagi's antenna, and then interface with the waveguide? And to
actually. Wait a minute, Yagi's follow the inverse square law just like anything else.
I didn't hear that, Dr. Roy.
Let me see if I have this. Okay. Ed said that Yagi's follow the inverse square law like all other antennas, which is what I said, too.
That is correct. What is the difference between omnidirectional antenna? Actually, when we start from point source, then omnidirectional antenna, then Yagi, then interface, waveguide, and then interface. And to explain.
You can't make waveguide and antennas. It's a different animal.
I didn't get that, Dr. Roy.
Ed said you can't mix waveguides with antennas. They're two different animals. And again, I tend to agree with that. We've talked about antennas for decades. I think I sent you an email 10 years ago about isotropic and the nature of antennas. That rather than calling them a point source, for whatever reason, I like to call them isotropic for their propagation characteristics, which is that they're uniform 360 degree and they don't really exist. A nice example is the old incandescent light bulb, which is close to isotropic, but certainly not isotropic, because if you went to the bottom of it where the base is, you wouldn't see as much light as if you went 180 degrees in the opposite direction. So all antennas have a radiation pattern going from near isotropic to as collimated as electromagnetic waves can be due to their inherent diffraction limitations. But from one end to the other end, whatever that is out there in the far field in free space is going to experience an inverse square law. Now, if you put it into something else that's more a transmission line and not just a radiation into free space, then all bets are off and different characteristics occur. But again, as Ed mentioned, that's the difference between a radiator and a transmission line, be it a waveguide, be it some kind of a planar device to kind of trap the waveforms in the interface between a conductive and a non-conductive medium. They're all transmission lines, really. They're not really radiators.
Oh, I have a problem with that. At first, I didn't mix anything. I was talking about how does inverse square law apply to all of it. So it looks like I have to handle this question myself. Let me drop it.
He already gave you the answer.
Inverse square law is simply a matter that a radiated signal going in all directions follows a classic geometric square law as an infinite. Let's say you send out an infinitesimally small pulse of energy, and it goes out as a sphere. And it follows the geometry of a sphere, and it realizes it goes with square of the radius. A transmission line, you're not radiating out to space, so it only applies when you're radiating out to space. Sorry, Roy.
Don't say sorry, Ed. What you said is quite correct. We happen to live in a four-dimensional universe, space-time, and the way that things extend out in four-dimensional space-time is kind of lends the inverse square rule. So you said what I would tell you.
Okay. Oh, it looks like all around you is understanding. So, point source, you'll ask for more accurate definition. A point source is a single indefinable localized source of something. A point source has negligible extent distinguishing it from other source geometry. That's a point source. So we say that a point source for some reason is radiating, then it has a certain pattern. And we had a few months ago discussion, you were against the cylindrical waves. So now it's the time to explain that. A line source differs to the from point source in that the sound, we take the sound, is considered to radiate cylindrically away from a line rather than spherically away from the point. As with point sources, no real light radiator is true line source. However, there are some that we can approximately to be a line source at a certain listening distances. End of quote. Let me drop. So, point source creates spherical wave. Line source is your dipole, omnidirectional dipole. It creates cylindrical wave. That's what you said you couldn't find in the internet, Dr. Roy. Now, I was interested, what is the difference when we apply inverse square law to the Yagi antenna versus applying it to omnidirectional dipole versus applying it to the point source? What is the difference? Is there any? Intuition.
Well, firstly, there is no difference, in my opinion. I'll let Ed speak for himself. I have never read a single bit of comments suggesting otherwise.
Yeah, okay. First of all, a Yagi versus a dipole. Yagis and dipoles have three-dimensional radiation patterns. Once that pattern is established, everything drops off with range via the square law drop. There is no such thing as a point source, so I can't put it into this equation.
Well, if you deny physics, then I'm shocked. There is a point source. There is a line source. And there are plenty of other ways that we can apply, plenty of the other words like a plane wave that we can apply and we can explain something. But you're trying to say, no, some point source doesn't exist. Look at the internet and you'll find it. Interesting.
Is he saying the internet is itself a point source?
I'm sorry. Am I being understood? I understand that I have a problem with English. I understand. I repeat again. A point source is a single identifiable localized source of something. That's a point source. So you put the point in space and you make that theoretically point to radiate. And then from that point you have a spherical pattern of radiation. If you have a line source, which is, let's say, vertical dipole, it's a line, infinite line, then you have a cylindrical waves around. What's the problem? And to achieve.
Leslie? Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay. To the best of my understanding, point sources and line sources are theoretical constructs. They are very easy to write equations for. They do not exist in the real world because there is no device that you can build that has a zero dimension. If you were to truly develop a true zero-point source, it would mean that the source had a length of zero, a width of zero, and a depth of zero. You can't build that because nothing like that exists. A line source, a theoretical, complete, absolute line source, has only one dimension. Try and build something that only has one dimension. I don't think you can. I can't. I don't think Ed can. I don't think anyone can. So these are theoretical constructs for doing theoretical work. Then, unfortunately, you have to move them into the real world where they're not truly point sources. They're near point sources, maybe. They're near line sources, maybe. But they can't be absolute zero-point sources because, unfortunately, we live in a world that does have those four dimensions. And you can't build something that's dimensionless.
Well, if you know what we're talking
about. Certainly, Ed.
Every fractal antenna has an antenna pattern where it's based on working against an infinite, flat, perfectly conducting ground plane. So obviously, there are loads of infinite, flat, perfectly conducting ground planes. I just don't know how I missed them. Maybe I looked in the wrong place.
Okay, good point, Ed. I don't want to quibble with you, Wesley. It's just that you have to, at least I have to, keep in mind that a lot of the things that you read about in science don't exist in any real world. They're constructs that you can play around with and help you to understand more fundamental aspects of the universe. But when push comes to shove, you have to understand that they're not good representations of the real world. Again, as my example was, in theoretical electrical engineering, if you have an antenna that's 90 degrees of polarized angle, is 90 degrees from the other one, the amount of energy transferred is zero. Obviously, that's not the case because there's no perfectly line antenna. They're all some degree of elliptical aspect, so you never quite can be 90 degrees out of phase and both of them being perfectly linear. So that's what we're quibbling with. I don't think that you really enjoy quibbling, but that's my problem here.
And it's not just RF. I refer you to one Sajid Carnot, Carnot.
Okay. So there are spherical antennas, and they are in the real world. So we take point source and we take the sphere of given diameter. They behave the same, it would create spherical waves. There are dipoles, and the length of the line is the one that we need for antenna to resonate, and those are vertical dipoles, and the wave that is created pattern is called cylindrical wave. So it is not that I'm talking about something that is theoretical, I'm talking about something that is practical. And if it's needed, I can find those antennas and send you the email for it. But my question was, what is the difference between inverse square law applied to point source, line source, so that means the spherical antenna, the vertical dipole, and Yagi antenna? What is the difference? It must be some difference because the width, the collimation, if we could use this word, of the Yagi antenna is different than the one of the omnidirectional antenna and the point source. And then, if we think about the pipe, there is a pipe and there is a water in the pipe. That water cannot go left, right, it can go through the pipe. And now we change this water for electromagnetic wave. That is the way that the electromagnetic wave actually flow in it, if the dimension is right for the waveguide. And then we have a flat waveguide, which is called interface, where we're dealing with conducting or lossy conducting medium and the dielectric. But we could have also with two dielectrics, if we will, or if we wish. So the only difference, the only question was, what is the difference? Anti-HGS.
ZDH with a comment?
Yeah, practical question in that, Roy.
Okay, John and Ed recognize I just want to put my 2 cents worth in, because it sounds like you flip back and forth between transmission line and antennas again, which is just going to confuse a lot of people, including myself, in that transmission lines aren't the same as antennas. And a hose might be a good analogy, sort of, for a transmission line, but it's a terrible one for an antenna. Anyway, so I guess John's first, and then is that?
Yeah, an example, if we take a dipole, or, you know, a regular halfway dipole, horizontal dipole, it's a line antenna, okay, a finite line. Okay, right around the antenna, when you're close to it, you see that famous pattern of like a toroidal with a line going right through the middle. But when you get out into the far field, it becomes a plane wave. When you're close in, yeah, you see that cylindrical wave, as Wesley mentioned. But in the far field, you see a plane wave. And in the far field is where it is, it obeys the inverse square. Go ahead.
Okay, let me just make sure I have it. Okay. I mean, everyone's sort of been mentioning this repeatedly, that we really should keep on the far field, because near field things are very, very wacky. I've mentioned it before that orthogonal electromagnetic waves hang out in the near field, dissipate before you get to the far field, and then your electromagnetic waves are in phase. But Ed, you wanted to say something?
Let's play Albert Einstein and over the thought experiment. He takes a regular dipole, two transmitter, out in space, and you put a sensor between this dipole and say where the star series is. And you measure it, and you will find that the dipole will say give you 1 micron. Now you obliterate this and replace it with these arcs. And depending upon this angle, measured the same way, depending on which way the yagi is pointed, you might get 1 microvolt to 10 microvolts. There, you got that hell of a large range, but you're there. But both of those, as you move your sensor out in the direction of Sirius, they're all, while starting off at different points, you have different gains in different three-dimensional directions, they all drop off by the same square law, before the signal spreads out in a spherical form, regardless of how it starts, and drops to the square law drop.
Okay, very good. Ed, I agree with you. That's what the inverse square law means. It doesn't mean that the amplitudes are the same for antennas that have different radiation patterns and so-called gain. That's another term that always annoys me. Antennas are defined by their gain. Some people who don't know any better kind of think that it's the same gain that an amplifier has. But an antenna's gain is a passive phenomenon by simply compressing the propagation radiation to a narrower region. But you know, they might all give you a different measurement, as Ed just mentioned, but they will drop off with the same inverse square law because they're going through free space. That's four dimensional.
Okay, that was time for my balloon
too. Okay.
Boy, they just want to say, you have a balloon, let's say the size of a baseball, you know, a little balloon, and it's not fully inflated. This is an antenna pack, and by pressing it different ways, you can get any three-dimensional antenna pattern you want, but the volume remains the same. If you put 10 watts into any antenna with a decent SWR, that stimulates this balloon. The pattern is pulsing and prodding. If it's a highly directional antenna, you might really squeeze it and have it squirt out to one side. But the volume inside the balloon remains constant for any antenna. You want a bigger balloon, you add more transmitter power.
Okay, very good, Ed. Now, Wesley, I get the distinct impression that you have an answer to your question that I think that you wish to share with us. So if that's the case, then feel free. And if anyone has any comments thereafter, I'm sure they'll like to voice them.
Actually, I came out with that question 30 seconds before I decided to push the button, so I wasn't totally prepared for it. My understanding is that the more spread of the power, the most spread of the power is with point source, that would be spherical antenna. Then we have cylindrical pattern, which is a vertical dipole, which is a plane wave, actually, as a part of the cylindrical wave pattern. And that was actually a good answer. Now, if we have Yagi antenna, we actually have very much directed beam, still spatial, but it is very much collimated. So if inverse square law apply to that as well, the difference is that the power is actually directed in one direction. So Yagi antenna, definitely inverse square law applies to it, but we have more power at the distance, at a given distance. And then we're talking about transmission line, that which you say. I would have a problem with this, but I don't want, let me jump. But I don't want to go to more discussion, as it's going to become boring. We have a waveguide. Inverse square law doesn't apply to waveguides and doesn't apply to strips, which is the interface. It doesn't matter if the interface is made from two dielectrics having different dielectric properties, or conductive medium and dielectric, or lossy conducting medium and dielectric. It doesn't matter. It doesn't apply. Of course, we have a losses, but those losses are not in within definition of inverse square law. So that's my point. And to
okay. Again, not quite sure. I mean, it sounds very similar to the way that Ed mentioned that if you collimate, if you concentrate a signal in one direction at any kind of random distance from it, you'll increase the received signal strength. The problem that I think you're having is that you think that by collimating it, you somehow lessen the effect of the inverse square law, where there's less than an inverse square attenuation. In real life, as far as I'm aware, with a lot of physicists studying a lot of things, that hasn't been demonstrated anyplace. I mean, there are guys out there. If you want to confuse yourself, simply Google whether a collimated laser beam obeys the inverse square law. You'll find a lot of guys, I think, without any kind of degrees, who will tell you that it does violate the inverse square law. But it don't. You know, again, physicists would mention it to someone. It would be written in a book somewhere. So although our intuition might be that since it's collimated, inverse square isn't going to have an effect. But again, because of the diffraction, absolute diffraction limitations of the light source, it's going to spread out in such a way that it will demonstrate once again the inverse square law in free space.
What I wanted to point at
Dr. Roy. Oh, actually, you asked about light. When light is collimated or focused into the straight beam using a parabolic reflector, let's say, the inverse square law does not apply, and the light maintains its intensity and vibrance as it travels. So what I was trying to say is, if we want to just eliminate inverse square law, starting from the worst, which is point source, then going to a little better, which is vertical dipole antenna, which is cylindrical wave, then going to Yagi antenna, which is much better, and then going, but not mixing antennas, we're talking about the source of electromagnetic energy, which would be an antenna, point source, line source, and the beginning of whatever waveguide we use, including interfaces. So, by only collimating it, that was a good answer. The other person said that. We actually eliminating inverse square law. So tell me that I'm not right about light. The light, the collimated light, the inverse square law doesn't apply to. And to issue.
Wait a minute. All the parabolic dish antennas I worked on follow the inverse square law. And there were reams and reams of test data run on antenna ranges, real world experience to prove it.
Yeah, let me see if I have it, by the way, AC2GS. Okay, I was going to be kind of flippant and just repeat what you just said, that tell me that I'm wrong. I was going to say, well, you're wrong, Wesley. You're wrong, Wesley. Collimated light is attenuated according to the inverse square law. And as Ed mentioned, parabolic mirrors do have attenuation. They do spread out. You cannot physically send electromagnetic waves through free space without them diverging. They're ultimately the diffraction limit of any aperture is going to cause it to spread out. There is no such thing as a beam of light that infinitely flies through space without spreading out the surface area. It is not physically possible.
Oh, okay, let's go to it. We have a parabolic reflector, so it's a light collimator, right? Then it focuses the light into the straight narrow beam. So in this case, the entire output of the source is directed very efficiently into the parallel rays with minimal spread. Therefore, the density of the light rays and the intensity of the light remains much more consistent as the light travels. So for that reason, the inverse square law does not apply to focus light. We have losses, of course, but the losses are according to the inverse square law. So as a result, let me drop. As a result, when using a parabolic reflector in a focused position, the subject can be placed much farther away from the light without losing the vibrant quality of the light. So we usually refer to the light like this as having a long throw, using the focusing mount as you move the light source away from the focus position inside the reflector, the light starts to spread out and behave more like omnidirectional source. But it is gradual. Let me drop.
You know, you just made all of our anti-aircraft radars of every nation non-existent.
Let me finish. Gradually, the inverse square law applies when the light is fully flooded. My understanding that more light spreads out, the closer it should be placed to the subject. So overall, this is one of the reasons why parabolic reflector is such a good or versatile light shaper, because it can act as both the focused light and diffused light and everything in between. So I'm not saying that we don't have losses. I'm just saying that inverse quill load doesn't apply. Enter a cheer.
Roy, he doesn't know how many of these things I've worked on. You want me to give a little lecture on the subject of parabolic events?
Well, we certainly do have the time tonight. I don't know what to tell you, Wesley. You're kind of telling people things that I guess intuitively might make sense. The fact that a parabolic reflector will concentrate the light pattern to a very narrow one, and because it constricts the illumination, it brightens things up much more. Again, the problem I have, I think the problem Ed has practical experience with it, that if you measure the light intensity and then you go twice as far away, it's going to be one-fourth of that intensity because it's going to follow the darn inverse square law. You seem to think that because it's tightly focused, it's not going to have the same ratio. The problem is that it's not the same amplitude because a narrower beam starts much brighter, but the relative brightness will change in the same way that the inverse square law provides. And that has been Ed's experience through many years of working with these things, and that has been my understanding having read many books on the subject. I have never come across anything legitimately that suggests different. Again, if you Google collimated lasers, you will find interesting people with, I don't know exactly where they got it, saying absolutely not. It violates completely the inverse square law. If you kind of find a physicist and tug him on the shoulder and ask him, he'll tell you it doesn't. So that's my understanding. Ed, you want to kind of expand upon that?
I would like to finish that, because then we're going to be in between the comments, so I would like to respond to what you said.
Okay, sure, Wesley.
The whole sense of this discussion is because I'm taking the opposite side, like a devil advocate. So it means if I was to agree with you, there would be no discussion. 5 minutes? 5 seconds? So let me continue. Light doesn't mysteriously die out as it travels. If it is spread out, it either spreads out or is absorbed or reflected when it hits an object. So if a beam of light spreads out, the density of light rays decreases in a given area. What we interpret as light losing its intensity. So the inverse square law is a property of spherical geometry, not light. Again, spherical geometry, not light. That's what inverse square law is about. So only directional light fills an every expanding sphere of coverage as it travels away from the source. So as the distance from the source increases by, let's say, 2x, the area of the sphere increases by coverage as it travels away from the source. Let me drop it. As the distance from the source increases by, let's say, 2 times, right, the area of the sphere increases by 4, and therefore the density of light rays in a given area decreases of 1/4, the inverse square law of 2. So focused parabolic light emits light collimated, well, the parallel rays, so therefore the inverse square law does not apply. And because the inverse square law is a property of spherical geometry, not light. Enter a cheer.
And why did you say that?
Yes?
Hi, I'm wondering, Wesley, whether you're talking about light waves or light particles.
No, don't make it that easy. Dr. Roy.
I think I may have something there.
I mean, this would be a perfect place to plop a wave-particle duality into this curious conversation.
The whole thing is that the more diffuse the light source, the more quickly it loses its measured intensity. and the closer you want to place the light to your subject and to XGN.
You are wondering if down by the inverse square law. I have only a few ways of saying the same exact thing. And usually when you're playing devil's advocate, you're kind of forcing everyone to either understand the other side better or a curious aspect of the other side better. Usually devil's advocate isn't meant to win the argument, but I don't think this argument is being won that way either, but so I'm a little confused. I think what some people, different people have different problems with the concept of diffraction limitation and collimation and relative attenuation versus absolute attenuation. So if you've got all those ducks in a row, hopefully it makes a lot more sense that in free space, once again, electromagnetic waves radiate out and spread out such that their signal is attenuated by the inverse square law.
You guys continue. I have to leave you for a moment because I have a problem. My cat went into the glass jar. I have to help my wife. I'll be right back if I can.
Am I making it to the repeater?
Yes, but that was the first time I've heard you here tonight, David.
Bravo, Zulu.
Yes, Rich?
Two things. One, at the end of this the section when I was asking about Ohm's Law, there was a good 3 minutes when I didn't hear anything but a carrier. So I don't know if there were any comments at the tail end of it. That's number one. Number two, please permit me to ask Ed, EAB, if he's a reloader, and if he is, may I send him an email if he's good in QRZ?
Let me answer that. The answer to the question is yes. 48.5 range of IMR 4895 behind 150 range full metal jacket bolt motel in a 30-06. There's my speed rate. My email is simple, wb2eab@yahoo, and I was about to start talking about minutes of arc, which as any target shooter knows, is 1 inch at 100 yards.
All right, I'm having trouble with a expander, you know, expanding the net to seat a bullet problem. So talk on the phone. Back to you, Roy, and I did have a question that I may have missed at the very end of it right now, but I'll let you tell me if I could ask a real quick question.
Regarding the first one, definitely, but not here, email.
I have a question for Ed.
Okay, ask Ed a question. If Ed wants to answer the question.
Well, you know, I hear you talking about the inverse square law. Inverse square law for reflected light readings for photography, you know, like F2, F4, F5, 6, F8, F11, F16, aperture inside of a lens camera, and shutter speed, which decreased, for say double, quadruple, 8 times, 16 times, etc., etc. How does this all relate to the inverse square law, as you're saying? Go ahead, sir.
Roy, the first 30 seconds to close out what I wanted to say, and then I'll address this.
Sure, Ed. Please, feel free.
Let us consider a highly directional parabolic dish antenna. Let us say it has a beam width. The width of the beam, 3 dB down from the peak is the standard, but it doesn't have to be 3 dB, that's about a 20 dB down there. Whatever. Let's say this tracking antenna has a 1 degree beam width, which is reasonable, a little high but reasonable. And what happens is, yes, you get tremendous gain. You get a much, much larger signal at any particular distance than you do with a lower gain antenna. But it still dissipates at 1 degree. If you're pointing this at the side of some large, flat surface, at 1 mile, you'll have a 1 degree circle that's only 20. And at 2 miles, you'll have a 1 degree circle that's 4 times as many square feet. So you just change the starting point. The rate of degradation is identical. Now, lasers. Lasers have beam widths of approximately, I believe, a minute of arc, or even better. And as I said, a minute of arc is fascinating. It's 1 inch at 100 yards. Nice and simple, easy to understand. But at 200 yards, it's 4 inches. So the inverse square law applies. U.S. Elroy?
Yes, yes. I understand. I hope everyone listening did.
Now, David, shutter speed is obvious. It's how long is the shutter open? F-stop is how wide is the lens. The reason for F-stops, the wider the lens and the lower the F-number, the more light you get into the film or sensor, whatever it is. If you are working in very low light conditions, on a very slow speed, and a very low, i.e. wide, F-stop to let the maximum light in, the problem is, the slower the speed, the more any kind of motion will give you blurring. Wider the f-stop, the narrower the field of focus, so you will not be able to be in focus and have blurring. And the art of photography back in the days of manual settings was to optimize them to the specific application in the good enough picture. Now, if you're taking a picture in really low light, good enough will probably not be as sharp as when you get brilliant sunshine, when you're actually trying to restrict the light to not saturate the sensor or the film. So this is how it is related, but only in that way. Roy for comment, WB2AB.
AC2GS. Well, I agree with you once again, Ed. Apertures are related to focal length, so that's how they calculate them. Shutter makes it's kind of easy that, you know, light that goes in over time. So the more time that you give the shutter, the more photons hit the imaging device. Just to kind of go back for a microsecond to David's original question about the inverse square law is kind of the third least important aspect of photography. It's simply that the path that the light is going to take, both to hit the subject and reflect back to the sensor, is going to have an inverse square law effect. But in most photography, that's not a heck of a problem. So most of the illumination control is done by aperture and shutter settings.
Interesting. Now, I want to add something. If you think about focus Fresnel lens that throw the light many miles, this is only possible because light beam is collimated. And look how the Fresnel lens look like. So that actually supports the statement that inverse square law is a property of spherical geometry, not light. I'm still dealing with my cat that went into the glass jar and doesn't want to get out. So you guys continue, I'm sorry.
Okay, Wes. Well, I wish you good luck with the cat. Again, I tend to disagree. You're able to capture it, the image, either because the illumination is started off rather bright to begin with, goes higher in density, or are you using a lens that's capable of a very wide aperture and things like that? Again, it is not because the light source is not having the inverse square law. We all see the sun out in the sky. That doesn't mean that it doesn't operate with the inverse square law. It means that it gives off a heck of a lot of light.
Do you think that there's some relationship between inverse square law and very high temperatures? You know, that the heat and the light carrying the heat in some places gives a very high temperature.
Sure, Ed.
There's nothing magical about inverse square law. It's simply that light, radio waves, any form of electromagnetic radiation that falls anywhere on the spectrum spreads out as it goes out to space. And like I said, a narrow antenna beam of 1 degree from a parabolic dish antenna stays at 1 degree. So at 1 mile, it may be, let me say, I don't know, a clear number, 10 square feet. At 2 miles, it's 40 square feet. It's just being spread out as they go away. And it affects all of this stuff. And that's all it is. There's nothing magical.
Okay, once again, I agree with you. If we lived in the 11 dimensions that string theory and M-brain theory would postulate, and they weren't curled up on themselves, maybe there would be a different type of law for radiation. But since we live in a four-dimensional world, that's the way things spread out. So again, I agree with you, Ed. To touch back on David's question, the only thing, as far as I can see, that the heat is going to do in Earth, you know, I mean, maybe in the middle of the sun, obviously heat does all kinds of interesting things, but the heat on the Earth, the only thing it really does is it's going to heat the air, and it'll have a slightly different refractive index. And so when different temperature waves of air hit light, you might see these odd little artifacts of the light, but it shouldn't really affect much the absorption or attenuation of light, you know, unless you've done something really wonky with the atmosphere.
So, if it spreads out significantly, would that affect the intensity of the light?
Absolutely.
Yes, that's the whole point of the exercise. It's the spreading out of the beam of light that causes the apparent attenuation. Because you measure the intensity per surface area, and as it spreads the surface area that it covers, it does it by the inverse square law, and so the intensity of the electromagnetic waves dissipates with the inverse square law. So it's the fact that the beam is spreading out. The people who put the mirror up on the moon, who shine a laser at it to figure out how far away it is and do all kinds of fun scientific studies, that laser beam covers a very, very wide area when it finally gets there, again, because light and electromagnetic waves disperse.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, Ed.
Hey, Roy, that reminds me of something. Why hear about my one-dimensional universe?
Okay, I have heard of Flatland. Flatland was, I don't know if it was a popular book, but I think it's still out there. You can probably, I think it was written a long time ago, so you can get it on the Internet. So Flatland is a theoretical a world that has two dimensions. So let's hear about your Lineland.
No, you're going the wrong way. This could be understood by a child. I was coming down the Hutchinson River Parkway in heavy traffic towards the Whitestone Bridge. And I said to my wife, you realize we're in a one-dimensional world. There's just a straight one line, one dimension, that we have to follow through the traffic to get to the bridge. That is a one-dimensional world. Yeah, there are other dimensions, but we don't care about them. We're interested in one direction, follow the pipeline down to the bridge.
Get your car on the road, otherwise it would just kind of fall off the line.
Say again, Roy, there was a quadruple.
Okay, I just made a point that you kind of need an extra dimension to define a plane for the road that you're using. Otherwise, you'd be driving on a single line, which I don't think the axles of your wheels would work well on.
You're missing the primary point. It was 100% mental, none of it was physical.
I have a question. Does inverse square law, does sound go with the inverse square law?
Yes. Same exact rules.
Thank you. Very interesting.
And if you want proof, go to a target shooting range and your own ears will immediately detect. The further you are from the source of gunfire, it falls off fairly rapidly with distance. And something that's pretty obviously square law.
QSL, I don't know if I've had that experience before, but we were using, .22 millimeter rifles. We were shooting targets. And I don't remember any fall off there.
Wait a minute. Yeah, you mean 22 caliber rifles. Yeah, all right. I promise you, somewhere in the world, right now, somebody's shooting a 22 caliber rifle. If there was no fall off, you'd be hearing it.
QSL. It was pretty noisy. We had a great time.
Agree 100%, but that's not incompatible with what I said.
Yeah, inverse square law and sound.
Yes, absolutely, because it dissipates in a three-dimensional world. And the surface area of an expanding three-dimensional field, sphere, which is the sound wave is expanding in a three-dimensional expanding sphere at the speed of sound, not light, where it's 1 over R squared.
Does the frequency of the sound have anything to do with it?
Not specifically, but there might be some minor second order effects I can't think of, but in the first cut, absolutely no difference.
Yes, KG2RY. Well, you know, what if the frequency of the sound is approaching radio frequency, you know? And is that sort of like the cutoff point for the inverse square law and the speed of sound versus however fast a radio frequency travels?
There is overlap between audio frequencies and radio frequencies. Ultrasonics go up into the hundreds of kilohertz, yet they still are vibrating air molecules. And you have RF in the hundreds of kilohertz, where classic electromagnetic theory. But the geometry is the same, but practically nothing else is.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I remember studying this years ago when I first got involved with the inverse square law. The best drawing I saw was, you know, you probably still find it in the amateur books. They showed a pinpoint source. And you draw four lines. You know, make a box at a certain distance away, pick a distance, and connect the one source to those four corners of the box, and then just keep extending those lines, going further, and just whatever distance that was, you know, it could be 5 inches, it doesn't matter. Now you make that, the next one, another 5 inches, double that distance. And then connect those four points where that ends, and then figure out that area, you're going to see whatever that box was, the first box, that next one is going to have four boxes in it. And then, again, if you go another, say, 5 inches, that would be, three times the distance. And you'll see the exact amount of boxes. You know, it'll follow the inverse square law all the way out. You know, 4, 16, and so on, and so forth. If you find the drawing on that, I think that's the best description. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I'll put it up on my link page because I have one of those. Let's see. I was going to make a point about something. The problem when we talk about sound waves and electromagnetic waves is this: electromagnetic waves, the medium is the vacuum of space, which is fine. You increase the frequency, it has no effect on the surroundings much. Unfortunately, sound waves require a medium. They're pressure waves. They're air pressure waves, and so you have to deal with ear. As you increase the frequency of the sound wave, you're going to increase the energy of the wave. Some of that energy is going to dissipate locally into the gas, heat the gas, and it's no longer going to be anything close to a perfect compressible gas. And there will be attenuation simply due to failure of the medium. This is why with ultrasound, it's much more conducive. They use the cream that has the same optical, quality. So they found sonographic waves into people's bodies with a little bit of a cream. If you did it with an air gap, you would have a great deal of attenuation. So there's a much wider range that electromagnetic waves can possess, where sound waves are limited by the complications of the medium that it's transported in.
WD3AD with a silly comment?
Certainly, Ed. Silly away.
I see that cream they use on the head of the sonogram sensor is an antenna tuner for ultrasonic.
Yes, it's an impedance interface.
When in Rome, do as the Romans do. It's not an impedance interface. It's an antenna tuner if you're a ham. Yeah, of course you're right. I'm just going with the flow.
Okay, feel free. But yeah, it's because it came up a couple of months ago. We were talking about limitations of sound and why they were limited. And I think I looked it up, and there were some research studies that suggested that you couldn't possibly get any kind of measurable audio signal once you ramped up into the megahertz of audio frequency. It's just, even if you made straight contact with the transducer, the distance between it, the micron, were enough to completely ruin the sound propagation.
But I think that violates the generic rules that David was talking about when he opened the megahertz.
Yeah, well, again, the problem is that waves, you got to take into account the medium that they exist in. Thankfully, electromagnetic waves don't exist in ether. They exist in the vacuum of space-time. But the sound does propagate through air, and air is full of nitrogen and oxygen, and it doesn't like to be heated up to thousands of degrees, getting back to David's mention about how temperature might affect life.
Oh, waves. Did I ever tell you I'm afraid of waves?
What kind? Water waves?
Yeah, getting dumped into the sand at the beach hurts.
Oh, okay. Waves are good for some people and terrible for others. I have a good question, hopefully a good question. Did anyone out there come up with something else that has a inverse square law that we all know and love?
AG2R1.
I got the first.
Yeah, first David, then Ed.
No, I'm refusing until people give up.
Okay, then it's over to you, Dave.